I don't know. I'll have to look it up. I have it in some notes, in some previous notes. I'll try to look that up. I like that verse, too.
Proverbs 3:5. That's good, too. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your path.
That's right, and there's so many like that. Proverbs, in fact, you know, we have a whole month extra in this quarter. It's an extended quarter, and that's one reason I haven't gotten too anxious about if we don't finish a lesson, we'll just pick up the next week where we left off, because I'm trying to think, okay, what are we going to do if we get through with Esther? Well, one of the things I think I would like to do is go through some of the Proverbs and apply them to Haman's character, to Mordecai, to Esther, to Xerxes, to us. And there's so many that have come to mind or throughout the reading of Esther that I think, wow, boy, that Haman, if he had only paid attention to God's wisdom, instead of his own wants. And anyway, so that is a potential lesson, is to go through some of the Proverbs and see how they apply to the book of Esther. All right, so I think we'll start in the very end of Esther 3, because we talked about, okay, the decree's gone out. Let's review a little bit. Haman is, what is his beef?
He wants to annihilate completely.
And why? Why was that? How did it start?
Mordecai wouldn't bow.
Okay.
And he went to the king and said, you know, did you know, hey, there's a guy out here. He's not, and it's your command. You know,
right.
Mm-hmm. He won't. And he signed off on everything and said, well, yeah. And he didn't want to just take care of Mordecai. He wanted them all.
Right. He just,
everybody.
His rage just took over, and it burned in him uncontrollably, and he just went from one person that he disliked, and it's very likely he did not like the Jews anyway, but he wasn't content to take care of Mordecai.
We're trying to find out last week why Mordecai would not bow down to him, and in my research this week, I found out that in tradition, Talmudic tradition, they say that Mordecai, Haman was wearing the idolatrous image on his clothes. So every time somebody would bow down to him, he would bow down to that idolatrous image.
Oh, okay. So he had some kind of religious Persian god idol image.
And every time somebody would bow down to him, it was not to honor the man, it was to honor the image.
Oh. That's an interesting. I hadn't read that one. That's interesting.
It's
okay.
Just, tradition.
Right.
There's nothing scriptural about it. That's how the rabbi explained.
Okay. Very interesting. Okay, so yes, Haman has, and he's gotten the king's attention. I wonder if he even had the king's attention. You know, the king is kind of a wimp, and. But it said that, you know, we talked about Haman consulting the his astrologers and, well, casting lots. And that usually meant not so much in the Jews' culture, because they cast lots with God's, approval. Yes, thank you. The words are leaving me. But he cast lots in a different way. He was consulting mediums and astrologers and the so-called wise men. And Nikki's going to talk about the religion of that time in a little bit. But knowing what we know about the outcome of Haman, isn't that ironic that he would consult the stars? And we did read a verse last week that said the lot may be cast into the lap, but God has control. God had control of this, even though we don't hear God's name. We see him and we see his hand and everything. Okay, so the scribes are summoned, and they get busy. They're Haman's dictating this decree, and they're writing in all kinds of languages that goes out to all 127 provinces. And they're getting it done as quickly as possible. And Haman seals each one with the king's ring. He has the king's stamp of approval. It's like a power of attorney. And the king is probably oblivious to even what's going on. They're to destroy every Jew, young and old, women and children, save no one, seize the plunder, and that's to happen on one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, Adar. So they have 11 months until this happens. This decree was also given out in Susa, in the citadel area, and that is how Mordecai came to know of it. And what do Haman and Xerxes do to celebrate?
Sat down to drink.
Okay, it's not enough that we have these big banquets that last half a year, and then another week, and then Esther's banquet, you know, to celebrate her, but now we're going to kill a whole race of people, and let's sit down and have a drink, or as many as we can hold. And how did this affect the city? Confusion, okay. And we know how it affected Mordecai. And you know, there were people who hated the Jews, but there were also many people who were their neighbors and their friends, and they saw them lead upstanding lives. And they must have been just as perplexed and anguished as the Jews were. And wondering what in the world caused this. So Haman's sitting down to drink, and he's quite smug, and he's quite proud of getting the king's approval on this, and his contempt for the Jews is really being satisfied, isn't it? And Xerxes has sat down to drink, and he's totally unaware of what he has done. Doesn't even know his wife is among those that will be killed. And so, you know, we have contempt for Haman, don't we? I mean, we can say all kinds of things about Haman, and can't he see what he's doing, and how could he be so mean and vengeful? And yet, what lengths will we go to get our way sometimes? Maybe not murder, but is murder not listed among other sins that we consider less, maybe lesser sins? But those sins can lead to things like that. Let's read, let's turn to Galatians 5:19. In fact, we'll just read 19 through 26. Kim, would you read that?
Now the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I also told you in time past, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. And those who are Christ's have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. Let us not become conceited, provoking one another, envying one another.
Okay. So if you read the fruits of the Spirit, anything that doesn't fall under one of those categories is a work of the flesh, is it not? And as we read through this list, the works of the flesh, we can see Haman easily, can't we? Fits of anger, envy, contempt, selfish ambition, jealousy. But I can see myself in those sometimes. And I think we all probably can, and we just need to make sure we get control of those things and turn them in a different direction and start working on the fruits of the Spirit and work on those a little bit harder. Any comments? Okay. Also, let's see, I'll just read this real quick. You don't need to turn. 1 John 3:15. Anyone who hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life in him. That's Haman, but if we have hate for another, that's us. All right, so do we sometimes, you know, if we get in a situation where we feel like, oh, we'd sure like to take care of this particular person or situation, and we, do you ever feel that God's not there, that God's not in control, and I want to be in control? That's so easy, isn't it? It's, I guess it's human nature, but it's not the nature of God, and so that's why we need to be working on these fruits of the Spirit. All right, so the next chapter is chapter 4. In fact, we're going to let Nikki give her report now. And since we were talking about the lots and Haman consulting astrologers, we know this happened in other Persian times, in Daniel's time. Remember, the king wanted to know what his dream was? And he would consult his wise men, his sorcerers, his astrologers, and they couldn't tell him what he wanted to know. And God gave Daniel that information and that gift, and Daniel was able to. And that's how Daniel, besides his personality, he was able to gain favor with the king. And that's how God worked. His providence was with his Jewish exiles. They may have sinned and may have been taken off to be punished, but God worked in them and in their lives to for good. So Nikki's going to do a report on Zoroastrianism.
Well, another point was that Adar was the month that they chose in Kislot. It seems like that month coincided with one of the idols' feasts that they had, so that was Haman's way of trying to pump up the people. This is a day when you're going to celebrate your own God, and this is when I'm going to punish the Jews. So he was trying to make both points in the same time. It's high tech only because I'm not good with words, so I'm going to read a lot. I didn't need my kids, but I'm going to need my kids to read it for me. And follow the slides, don't follow me. Trust your eyes, don't trust your ears. Okay, Zoroastrianism, official religion of Persia, and for about 1,000 years, it was one of the most powerful religions in the world. And it started close to the 6th century before Christ. And before we know, Persian Empire that covered three continents, Asia, Europe, and Africa. In the beginning, it was just small tribes of Iranian people. They had their own religion and their own little gods that they were worshipping. So it was called Indo-Persian polytheism. Theos for God, Greek word, and poly means many, many gods. And they had originally worshipped many minor gods before the teaching of Zoroaster, which he will be the one that starts the religion. And this religion was adopted by Darius Xerxes, later on the two kings, that one of the most important kings of the Persian Empire later on. So we're going to work our way up to 485 when Xerxes reigns, and that's the time when Esther takes place. So it's going to be small amounts of time, and we'll talk about each one of them as much or as little as we can. We think that we know when the prophet was born, which was around 628, and died about 551, so he lived for about 77 years. This was the lifespan, and he is considered to be the first non-biblical monotheist. Again, theos, God, mono, one God. He's the one that studied religion of one God, sounds a lot like Judaism, and the two religions have a lot of points in common. And if you read a lot of scholars, most of them believe that this religion, Zoroastrianism, is the one that influences Judaism and Christianity later on. But if you're biased like I am, you know Christianity is the one that influenced this religion. He was born into a time which was Middle Age, the Bronze Age, when they discovered the metal. So they decided to use the metal to bring war to the people, to bring their chariots and the weaponry made out of metal. So he was born in this time when the life was getting hard. The old order was breaking down through the development of the disruptive militarism. Bands of chariots, riders terrorized the people, killing herdsmen and stealing the cattle. The victims were suffering and in distress, creating the classical situation for a prophet to arise, to offer salvation through consolation and hope to the people. The revealed faith of Zoroaster was to become the oldest recorded faith of salvation. Around the year 650 before Christ, into a priestly family in the region of Herat, or Afghanistan, was born the Persian prophet Zoroaster. His original name was not Zoroaster, but Zarathustra, meaning yellow camel in ancient Iranian. Zoroaster is a Greek transliteration of the name. And we find this because around 300, the Macedonian conquered this part of the world, and they had so much respect for this religion that before they burned all their libraries and all their books, they actually translated a lot of their teaching and a lot of their books. So Greeks picked up some of this teaching, translated them, and that's how we have them today, as a second hand, not so much the original book. Later, Zoroastrians found their prophet's name meaning yellow camel, rather primitive, so they claim, and some still insist, that Zarathustra means golden light in ancient Iranian. He was considered to be a reformer of the ancient Persian religion, which was the sole domain of the aristocratic military families. His notions of justice and personal conscience clashed head-on with the customs and ideas of these old families. The religion of Zarathustra was a new concept based on tolerance, respect for others, doing good, and struggling against evil. It is more probable that Zoroaster learned and was influenced by the Jews who fled from Israel to avoid being taken captured by the Syrians. And I took this opinion, being biased. Zoroaster traveled far and wide, and one day he met a prince named Vishtaspa, who adopted this religion, reforms, and offered Zoroaster his protection against the ancient religious caste. When Zoroaster marked the initial success of his prophetic mission by converting King Vishtaspa to become a Zoroastrian, he was already 40 years old. So let's see what happens between his birth and 40 years old. How did he get all of this information? Before his first vision, he had spent years in wilderness meditating and trying to reach God. At the age of 30, Zoroaster had a divine vision while bathing in the river during a pagan purification rite. On the bank of the river, he saw a shining being made of light reveal himself as Vohumana, or Good Mind. Vohumana led Zoroaster to the presence of Ahura Mazda. And a side note, those are us that are driving a Mazda. Now we know where the name comes from the car. Driving a Persian god. And five other radiant beings, which are called Ameshas Pentas, or Holy Immortals. This was the first of a number of visions in which Zoroaster saw Ahura Mazda and his Holy Immortals. And during each one of them, he asked many questions. The answer given to Zoroaster are the foundations of Zoroastrian religion. At last, he received perfect knowledge of past, present, and future, he thought. The Zoroastrian concept of God incorporates both monotheism and dualism. Again, monotheism, one God, dualism, it's good and evil. But there's a difference between them because God is above evil. They are not on the same level, so we're not worshipping God, but evil is still present. In his vision, Zoroaster was taken up to heaven where Ahura Mazda revealed that he had an opponent, the spirit and promoter of evil. Ahura Mazda charged Zoroaster with the task of inviting all human beings to choose between good and evil. Zoroaster taught that man must enlist in this cosmic struggle because of his capacity of free choice. Thus, Zoroastrianism is a highly ethical religion in which the choice of good over evil has almost cosmic importance. Zoroaster taught that humans are free to choose between right and wrong, truth and lie, light and dark, and that their choice would affect their eternal destiny. And if it sounds alike like Judaism and Christianity, it is alike. They have a lot of points in common. They have worship of the candles, God world created in 6 days, Adam and Eve, a law given to Moses on a mountain, and a lot of common points. And the holy book is called Zenda Avesta. The first picture was a picture of this book, and is believed to be written by Zoroaster himself. 551 is when Zarathustra passed away. And if you wonder what happened and how long this religion lasted, as pure as his preaches, until the day he died. And after he passed away, the clergies of that period tried to incorporate the doctrines of beliefs, of previous beliefs in Zoroastrianism, to pave the way for their own personal benefit. In this manner, after the death of Zarathustra, the religious of Mithra and Anahita, those are two previous gods, became so popular in Persia that the king Xerxes, the king that it's present in Esther's book, was worshipping Mithra, Anahita, next to Ahura Mazda. Anahita is the god that is believed to have the celebration on the day that Haman picked to punish the Jews. Next period of time, 559-530, first king, Cyrus the Great, is the one that started the Persian Empire as we know it today. He has an influence in Judaism, he has an influence in Jews' religion and in the Bible, so I picked him just so we see the influence of this religion in his life and how that affected the Jews. And Cyrus the Great was relatively liberal. While he himself ruled according to the Zoroastrian beliefs, he made no attempt to impose Zoroastrianism on the people of his subject territories. The Jews most famously benefited from this. Cyrus permitted them to return to Jerusalem from the exile in Babylon and rebuild their temple. This act of kindness made a huge impact on Judaism. Cyrus ruled with a spirit of tolerance that stood in contrast with his two predecessors, who had not the slightest respect for human life. The following records of destruction are attributed to them: murder, bloodbath, piles of heads at the entrance to the fortified cities, impalements and skinning alive of the prisoners, corpses horribly mutilated, left out in the open for wild animals and vultures to eat, ferocity towards women and old people, and enslaving boys and girls after subjecting them to terrible abuse. So if you ever wonder, like I did, why God did not have to send 10 plagues to let his people go from this Babylonian captivity, it's because God worked on his heart through Zoroaster. He brought this religion ahead of time, worked on his heart, so when the time was right, he had this kind of conscience that will allow the people to go without God having to have any special intervention. And Isaiah was able to prophesy about even his name. Next king is Darius I the Great. And we'll see a mention of his dad's and mom's name, and that tells you he's not the son of Cyrus the Great. He was a distant relative. So the fact that he got the throne, not inheriting through a succession, straight succession, kind of gave him a lot of thankfulness towards this god. And we have a number of inscriptions that talks about his thankfulness of becoming the king of kings. So according to history of the Persian Empire, Darius the great father and mother knew the prophet Zoroaster personally and were converted by him to the new religion he preached, which was Zoroastrianism. It is well established that Darius was an adherent of Zoroastrianism. This through the inscription that we have still preserved. Darius believed that Ahura Mazda has appointed him to rule the Achaemenid Empire, another word for Persian Empire. Darius believed that because he lived righteously, Ahura Mazda supported him. In many cuneiform inscriptions denoting his achievements, he presented himself as a devout believer, perhaps even convinced that he had a divine right to rule the world. In the lands that were conquered by his empire, Darius followed the same Achaemenid tolerance that Cyrus had shown. He supported faith and religion that were alien as long as the adherents were submissive and peaceful, sometimes giving them grants for his treasury for his purposes, their purposes. He had funded the restoration of the Jewish temple, which had originally been decreed by Cyrus the Great. So again, this kind of conscience helped the Jews rebuild the temple and testified the decision that his predecessor took. Next king, and this is our king from Esther, is Xerxes the Great, direct son of Darius the First, not the eldest, but the eldest that was born while he was in purple, while he was a king. Like his father, Darius the Great, Xerxes was a worshipper of Ahura Mazda, but not to the exclusion of other gods. And again, like his father, he acknowledged him to be the creator of heaven and earth, of men and of men's happiness. In spirit, Xerxes is further removed from Zoroaster than was his father. We see the religion and the teaching kind of diluting with each generation. But he seems to have consciously adhered to a distorted form of the prophet's religion as interpreted to him by the Magi. And then we'll talk a little bit about the Magi, this important group of people. During his military exploits, Xerxes incorporated part of Egypt into his kingdom and on the western side marched into Greece. This is the meeting that they had before with the banquet while they were planning to go invade the Greece. This brought in several foreign influences, and Zoroastrian theologians had to make compromises to assimilate several non-Zoroastrian divinities. So now the priests and the magis were forced to bring other divinities in and somehow make it work together with Zoroastrianism, make it all together. Now we see there's a difference between the pure teaching of Zoroaster, and that's called the primitive Zoroastrianism, and the later on version of the Zoroastrian, which is called Catholic, only because there were a lot of gods introduced later on. So we see how this diluted over time, and we see the changes that started probably with Cyrus and after his death. Although the religion of Zoroaster was a rebellion against the pre-existent polytheistic religion, some of the old deities from the mythological and naturalistic era were readmitted into the practice of the religion. While Ahura Mazda still remained the supreme god, the religion lost its concept of true monotheism in the real sense. And there are three important changes, maybe more, just these are the ones that I chose. The primitive Zoroastrianism gave the central place to Ahura Mazda, and therefore man as the bodily symbol of this god on earth. The Catholic, the later on version of Zoroastrianism, gave the most important place to time and destiny. Destiny displaces the central concept of choice that requires men to choose between God, good and evil, and be individually responsible. Destiny is a concept which provides the human soul with no escape, and that's why the Magi was using caste for Haman, and that's why every time they were going to war, the priest will go, the king will go in front of the priest, and they will cast lots, make sure this is the right timing for them to go to war and conquer Greece and conquer Egypt. They did not believe in good and evil anymore, and the decision that comes out of it will have an eternal consequence. Another change concerns sacred buildings as places of worship. Zoroastrians considered it wrong to keep Ahura Mazda shut up in the walls. His dwelling place was the whole world. And regardless, the Achaemenians, which is the Persian kings, erected temples for Anahita and other gods. And this is the most interesting one to me. The king claimed to have a special relationship with the supreme god. He was the king. He was king by virtue of God's will. Now remember, he conquered all these territories. Each of their territories have a king. He had to become the king of kings, the king on top of them. And to claim this position, he will have to say that I have this power coming from God. Nobody is above me. The sovereignty of the king became protected by the divine triad of the three, the god and the two little gods, Ahura Mazda, Anahita, and Mithra. Complicated court ceremonies made the great king an inaccessible figure, and the public had to pay divine homage by way of prostration before the king. And that's why Esther could not approach the king, because he was an untouched figure. He was God appointed on earth, and you have to go to him for certain ceremonies and be accepted by him. Now, this group of people, Magi, in Esther 3:7, when they say they cast lots, that day is not specified, but most of them believe it's this group of people, Magi. And from what I read, Haman had about 365 counselors. He ended up listening to his wife, so he's probably a smart man. So, from at least the time of Darius the Great onwards, the Magi were the official priests of the Achaemenian kings and played an important role at the royal court and enjoyed a great influence. Along with their religious functions, they were also engaged in administrative and economic activities, so they have a very strong position in that. And you mentioned Xerxes being not a strong king. That's right. He had a lot of these counselors, and they were pretty much ruling the kingdom for him. According to the Roman historian Pompeius, Zoroaster was the founder of a Magian science and knowledge of the stars. A few Zoroastrian texts speak of Zoroaster as an astronomer and someone who built an astronomical observatory. One of the primary purposes of the observatory was to measure time, maintain a very precise calendar, and predict the seasons and accompanying weather changes. In other words, applied astronomy. While the Zoroastrian calendar employed the zodiac of that time was used to predict equinoxes and solstices. The priests of Zoroastrianism, the Maga, were known to the Greeks as Magi, which is seen a plural form from Magos. When the classical Greek writers refer to Zoroaster as an inventor of astrology, they probably meant the Zoroastrian priest, the Magi, who were the inheritance of Zoroaster wisdom and who during the era of Persian Achaemenic Empire were renowned from the borders of Greece and Egypt to those of India and China as physicians, healers, astronomers, and even astrologers. These Magi were the one mentioned when Jesus was born, was the one that discovered, that could point the time and the place where baby Jesus will be found. These are the people. And now the decline. We have two dates here. Decline starts earlier on, but this is one major point in their decline. This is when Muslims conquer the Persia. After Muhammad was born and brought his religion, Muslims came in the name of Allah, and with the notion of one God who would tolerate neither a rival nor an equal. Their doctrine was simple and new, and their power was great. They had military power, so they imposed their view. Zoroastrianism, its people already being disunited and lacking an official support, slowly began to fall behind. So they were killed, and some of them just gave up out of fear. And the last dates we have in here, from the 10th century onward, groups of Zoroastrians immigrated to India until the end of the 15th century. So Zoroastrians settled in India, mostly in Bombay, and the ties to the Zoroastrian community was broken among them. They did not keep in touch. Iran with India. After the brutal persecution of Islam and massive flight to abroad, there were very few Zoroastrians left back in Iran. Even today, the number of Zoroastrians living in Iran probably doesn't exceed 10,000, and most of them live as a minority tribe. At the end of the 15th century, the connection between Zoroastrians in Iran and in India was reestablished, and it was kept in the form of letter exchange until 1768. Under British rule, the Zoroastrians in India started to enrich themselves through commerce. Throughout the long time, they also adapted themselves to the Indian culture. So when we send preachers to India to preach, they probably meet some of these people that they have to debate with. That's the end.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Very, very good.
Vicki, real quick.
Yes.
Did you happen to look into the effects of this religion on religions today?
Well, they say that it's influencing Christianity only because of the similar points. But they think that they study win here. And do you mean like any other religion except Christianity?
Well, any
and Judaism?
Other, like a Druidism or something like that.
I did not go into that detail. But I'm sure if it was a 1,000-year-long religion, I'm sure you had touched with any other religion and they were influencing each other. I don't think this was so strong enough to influence just one religion. I think they kind of got some things from each other and kind of melted together, as far as I can tell.
Thank you, Vicki.
Oh, thank you.
I love how those words that we stop to and stumble to pronounce, they just roll off our tongue.
Yes.
They do. It just kind of...
Expectation is lower, that's why it doesn't sound so bad.
No, it's not. A very thorough and good report on that religion of that time. Thank you so much. Okay, so we're into chapter 4, and this is... We're seeing Mordecai's reaction. So what three things did Mordecai do when he heard of this decree that was spread throughout the provinces to annihilate his nation?
He tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and he went out into the city wailing loudly and bitterly.
Okay. He was not allowed where? He couldn't go... into the king's gate. A person dressed like that, and that wasn't just common clothes, was it? That was the depth of despair and anguish and putting on something that looked so dirty and coarse and being of that temperament were not allowed at the king's gate. But this was not a time to sit and do nothing, was it? He was moved to at least show his anguish and despair and to move other people to join in that with him. And we know that the Jews were, that culture was not like we are. Remember we say a man shouldn't cry? A strong man won't cry. That, I mean, we don't feel that way really, but that's the way our culture is, to not to expect a man to cry. And the Jews showed their emotions so much more strongly than we do, whether it's a woman or a man. I mean, he was wailing. He was loud. He was, I don't know, we would consider it over the top and melodramatic, but that wasn't the case. And people knew that something was wrong. And so he was not going to sit by. This was a time not to hide his nationality any longer, was it? It was going to become known. Haman knew about it already. And that was his reason for the decree. But now Mordecai is kind of a turning point. Mordecai's saying, okay, let's do something about this. And we'll see that plan develop throughout the chapter. So he was not allowed to go up to the gate that way. Let's contrast that. We've already made a big deal about Haman and Xerxes sitting down to drink. And they were probably in their finery. Maybe he was in his robe with his gods on woven throughout that fine fabric. And Xerxes was in his royal finery and they were sitting down to drink. And Mordecai has put on this scratchy goat hair clothing and ashes on him. And we'll talk a little bit more about that next week too. And they're drinking as if the Jews are nothing. Just lowly worm on the ground. So that was the first bell. So I had a couple of songs that I wanted us to sing anyway for a while. I forgot. You know, last week I mentioned we made some comment about In God's Time, and it reminded me of In His Time. So we have that one that we can sing. Let's see. So we'll get a preview of the slide program anyway. Let me see if this works to go. Yeah, all right. In his time, in his time, he makes all things beautiful. In his time, Lord, please show me every day as you're teaching me your way, that you do just what you say in your time, in your time, in your time. You make all things beautiful in your time. Lord, my love to you I bring. May each song I have to sing be to you a lovely thing in your time. And ladies, whatever is going on in your life, whatever struggles you're going through, in God's time. And we're praying so hard for Garrett, for these others, but I think of Judy's family especially right now. She's so troubled that they're not faithful. And
I appreciate this song so much.
And we just pray that that will change.
And I appreciate your prayers so much.
Well, okay, and then we had, let's see, one more. I just have one verse of this. And this reminds me of how we're talking about Esther, and she went through beauty treatments. But now we're seeing a change in her. We're about to, in this chapter 4, where she takes a decisive turn in her life. And this is the beauty of Jesus, isn't it? So, let the beauty of Jesus be seen in me. All his wonderful passion. And that should be our prayer every day. I didn't go on because I thought the bell would ring before we even finished. But so continue. Go ahead and read. If you've already read chapter 4, read it again, and we'll get into that chapter. But, Nikki, thank you so much. That was a good report and very thorough, and we appreciate it. Interesting to hear what other religions were doing and thinking at that time.
A lot of this makes sense, more sense when you play the religious side. I mean, it kind of opened up my eyes a lot.